Hello, everybody. Welcome back to another Science Studio. This is Keith Pannell. I'm still in Stillwater, Oklahoma, still at Oklahoma State University. And today I'm going to be talking to someone who's in the sort of general area of what you might call plant biology. It's got a more grandiose name, but that will do for the moment. His name is Professor Andrew Doust. And Andrew, welcome to Science Studio.
Well, it's a pleasure to be here.
Oh, we're going to have a lot of fun, and we're going to learn a lot, too, because you're into something called genetics and plant morphology, and I read somewhere that, you know, you're into things like the shape of fruit, you know.
I'm into behavior.
You're into behavior?
I think so.
Plant behavior. I love it.
Yeah, well, not misbehaving, but
Oh, well, this is Oklahoma, after all. Let's find a little bit about Andrew when you were a young boy, young man. You know, how did you become a scientist? What were your driving sort of motivations, if you had any?
Did I have any motivations? That's a good question. I think as a child I was interested by stuff out there and stuff in here. So part of me was trying to work out who I was, and part of me was trying to work out what the world was doing. At that time, I was super interested in, I guess, ethology. I would read On Aggression when I was like 10 years old.
Conrad Lawrence.
Exactly, yes. Exactly. And then Nico Tinbergen and all those greats. And I used to follow ants around the garden, and I used to look at the Indian miners and what they were doing and try and think in terms of behavior of animals. And I think it really was kind of along the lines of zoologist, psychologist, very much into the intent of creatures, if you like.
Where was this?
This is in Sydney.
Sydney, Australia.
Yeah, suburban Sydney.
Okay, not so many animals in suburban Sydney. Outback.
We had Atrax robusta. We had redback. In this country, they call them black widows. Australia, they're just redbacks.
Black widows are really quite secretive. We have black widows in my back garden because it's a little plant where it's damp.
Right.
But you just don't put your hand in there and they leave you alone.
Exactly. Yeah, right.
They don't come out looking for you, right? It's not like some parasites and creatures.
But funnel webs in February, they go searching for their mates. So the males, who are the most dangerous, they go tromping around the place. They fall into swimming pools where they play dead for days at a time. They go underneath like washing machines. You have to be careful of your toes. They go into sheets and into camping. Yeah. In the 70s or so, these were a big kind of fear thing in places like Sydney, and because the anti-venom wasn't discovered till I think 72.
This is where you really got your beginning, looking at animals, wondering what were they going to do next.
And yeah, that's right. How was I going to be killed by them? Right. Things like that. Yes.
Okay. How long did that part of your life last?
Well, I went to a selective high school that was the first agricultural high school that was in a city. So it was in the middle of Sydney, but it was agricultural, and we had horses and cattle and sheep, and we had to grow radishes, and we had to pick up cowpats and all sorts of things. We didn't have pigs because pigs were not allowed inside the sort of city limits. But it was this agricultural high school, and it was a very high achieving yet pretty science based high school. And agriculture I loved. I kind of liked the practicality of it, I think. I didn't do biology, but I did agriculture instead. Then I went to university and didn't know what I wanted to do,
Where'd
course.
You go? Sydney?
University, yeah.
Okay.
And I went there because it looked the prettiest campus. So it had more sandstone. So I usually do things based on bad reasons, not not scientific ones. But in the end, I got a botany zoology double major and did an honors year doing botany. Botanists are calm people, and I like that calmness. So I chose to be a botanist because of the people who were botanists before me, I think.
Well, I mean, botany is a study of plants, and plants don't get too angry. Animals and all those other little creatures.
That's true, but I think one of my missions is to say to people, hey, plants are the only aliens that you're likely to meet in your life. You know, all of these movies with monsters that run around chomping you up, they're really not very different from us. But plants are completely different.
Do you read The Day of the Triffids?
Yeah, but that's plants behaving as animals.
Yeah,
Once they can get up and move around.
You're right.
But the essence of plantness is rootedness.
Okay.
I mean, and from that, they're much more sensitive than we are, and in a way much more responsive, because they have to be.
We got lots to talk about. You went away and studied for a PhD somewhere?
No, I didn't do that. I went to the Botanic Gardens in Sydney and worked for a while classifying plants. And then I was a tutor back at University of Sydney, enthusing people about botany. And then I decided that I'd have enough and I wasn't growing enough as a person, so I decided I'd leave and go around the world. And I learned Spanish for a while because I thought, I'm sure to end up in a country that has Spanish. That was my ticket. But in the last moment, I decided to go left out of Australia rather than right. because I thought, you know, India, they speak English as well, and maybe I'd be better off going that way around.
They often speak it better than we do.
Well, absolutely. Much better elocution and grammar. So I went to India first, and in the end, I never got to South America. And then I went to India, and then I went to Nepal, and then I really loved Nepal, and I stayed there for almost half a year. And then went to England, fell in love, started to make gardens because I needed money. You can't just be, love doesn't keep you forever. So, yeah, and then made gardens for a while before coming back to Australia, and then working a little longer, and then finally doing a PhD.
Okay.
I mean, I went to Melbourne to do that. So
the PhD, what was your first research topic?
So when I had been working in the gardens in Sydney, the job of a taxonomist, which I guess is what I was, a systematist, is to look at variation and try and think about what groups it falls into and then how those groups are related. So the relationships of things. It really got to me that I couldn't go any deeper than that, that I couldn't understand why these different forms came into being. So I went to Melbourne to really think developmentally. I really wanted to understand a group in its diversity through the development of, particularly, this was flowers I was particularly interested in, how flowers start off as just all looking like a nub of tissue and end up into the diversity that they appear. And then when I came to the States, and you can stop me if you want me to talk more about Melbourne. But,
no, just
But when I came
on.
To the States, it was kind of like to go to another level again. It was down, like, let's go to the genetic level. Let's go to the genes which control the development, which give the rise to the diversity. I mean, I really want to understand why a plant is the way it is. The way plants behave is fundamentally different. Yeah, I really wanted to understand kind of like what decisions does a plant make? What influences it? So there's genetics, but there's also the environment as well.
Yeah, well, I was just going to get to that because part of the environment for plants, and let's go back to trees, there's a concept called topiary, right? And that's when people get into there with their shears and they start doing things. And then they're, you know, the Japanese have these tiny little trees. What are they called?
Yeah, what
I mean,
is
are,
that?
Are they genetically distinct from the big
not
tree?
Not at all, not at all.
So, I mean, this type of little tree that people have in their offices,
they won't grow
to big trees,
This is a form of human bondage. That's what it really is. Because what you're doing is reducing the roots and the shoots in order that it will not grow into a tree. And you're doing...
these little critters alone, or these trees, they grow to big trees.
You get these little ones
I thought they were a special genus or something.
No. Like there are figs which should be 50 meters tall that are just made that way because plants are incredibly plastic.
This area is important for agriculture and things like that. So is part of your responsibility as a professor of plant biology to sort of also think about agriculture and efficiency of producing materials and plants? Or is that not part of what you do?
I think, you know, the way this university is structured is there are plant departments all over the place, but they're all, apart from us, they're all the applied. There's the horticulture, plant pathology, plant and soil science, which is to do with crops. So I think we're the department that does most of the basic plant biology, molecular, genetic, whatever, but with less of a focus on a particular pragmatic outcome and more on the basic science behind it. Having said that, though, I work on grasses, right? So I actually work mostly on a little bristle grass, which is a model for maize, for sorghum, for switchgrass. So it's a way of getting at these very large and cumbersome things to deal with by going to a model system first, like using fruit flies or mice for human research. And that's proved very useful here. We've got a long way.
Go back to those three, maize and
sorghum, switchgrass. Let's throw in sugarcane if you want. Yeah,
these are all the type of grass that actually have Azobacter, that they actually produce their own ammonia or nitrogen? They do not?
No, they don't. Okay. Now, these are the ones that are characterized. They all grow in hot reasonably moist some of the times, years. And so they have this particularly efficient way of taking carbon dioxide and making sugars, much, much more efficient than rice or wheat. And the way they do it is by not leaking out the carbon dioxide in the same way that those others do. So one of the big biotechnology goals that, in a way, the work I do, the work others like me do, is thinking about how do we make crops that are much better suited to the changing world we live in.
We're going to take a quick break here. My name's Keith Pannell. You're listening to Science Studio. My guest is Andrew Doust from the Plant Biology Department or something along those lines at Oklahoma State University in Stillwater, Oklahoma. And we'll be back in one moment.
Welcome to Medical Discovery News. I'm Dr. David Niesel.
And I'm Dr. Norbert Herzog. Fortunately, the Ebola outbreak in Africa is on the wane, but another related virus is now spreading in East Africa.
The Marburg virus outbreak began in Turkana, Kenya, with a game hunter who died after coming into contact with infected fruit bats.
Marburg virus belongs to a family of viruses called filovirus that includes Ebola. Like Ebola, it's spread by contact with bodily fluids or tissues, contaminated equipment, or other objects.
The latest outbreak began in September 2017 with the game hunter who lived near a cave inhabited by African fruit bats, which are the natural reservoirs for the virus. The man in his 30s developed a high fever, was vomiting, and had diarrhea.
He was treated for malaria at a hospital, but quickly worsened and died. His sister, who had nursed him, died next. The third victim was their brother. As is often the case with filovirus hemorrhagic fevers, two healthcare workers also developed symptoms.
Even though health officials try to contain the virus by tracking down everyone who came into contact with a sick patient, it's challenging since many East Africans have large families with elaborate burial rituals.
Other factors make containing this outbreak more challenging. Hospitals in the region keep patients in one large room, which allows transmission more easily. And Turkana is near the Kenya-Uganda border, which means as people move between the two countries, they could bring the virus with them.
The hope is that lessons learned from the Ebola outbreak of 2016 can be used to limit this and future outbreaks.
We are Drs. David Niesel and Norbert Herzog at the University of Texas Medical Branch and the Frank H. Netter School of Medicine at Quinnipiac University, where biomedical discoveries shape the future of medicine. For much more and our disclaimer, go to medicaldiscoverynews.com.
Welcome back to Science Studio. Keith Pannell, Andrew Doust from the Plant Biology Department at Oklahoma State University. And we were just talking about, you know, different types of plants, these grasses, as you put them, including maize as a grass. I never thought of that, but I'm a chemist. Why should I? But you mentioned something that if C4 rice could do something, something, something. What is a C4 rice?
This is great. This is actually the way I wooed my wife, believe it or not. So by explaining C4 photosynthesis to her. So it worked for her. So we'll see whether it works for you.
I'm married.
The way that we get sugars, the way that plants do that essential bit of magic, you know, taking the sun's energy, making it into chemical energy, and then using that chemical energy to take an atom of carbon and add it on to make sugars, is the essential part of that process is that there's a protein, an enzyme that catalyzes that process. So that enzyme has a long name, which I don't want to bring into the conversation right now, but its short name is Rubisco. Rubisco clearly evolved a very long time ago. And we think it did this because the C and the O on the end of Rubisco stands for carboxylase and oxygenase. So this enzyme has a dual action. It can fix carbon and fit it into an organic molecule, or it can fix oxygen. And it does that depending on the concentration of carbon and oxygen in the air. We think it evolved a long time ago because its useful, effective thing is to fix carbon. If it fixes oxygen for a plant, it produces a poison for the plant, which the poison has to spend energy getting rid of. So it's not a good thing if there's too much oxygen around. What C4 plants do, and what does C4 even mean? Well, C4 means carbon-4, and it means that there's an intermediary step in the process of photosynthesis that effectively allows carbon from the atmosphere to be shuttled through the plant into special cells and be released in an atmosphere which is kind of like pure carbon. So it's a way of concentrating carbon. It refers to that, the transporter, which has 4 carbons. But the essence is that the carbon from the atmosphere isn't fixed directly. It goes into a special holding cell where it's at high concentration and therefore the reactions work extremely well. So if that system of concentration could be introduced into plants that don't have that system, then those other plants would be very efficient at making carbohydrates, sugars, etc. for plant growth. I would add that that enzyme Rubisco is worst or is most likely to take oxygen in hot conditions. And where does things like rice grow? In hot conditions. And so it would make a big difference for something like rice.
And so the plants that you're talking about that you would like to be able to add this process to would be wheat?
Or wheat would be is another one, right, that suffers at high temperatures. Right. At high temperatures, as much as 50% of the photosynthetic gain is then lost again trying to get rid of these poisons. So it could make a huge difference, right?
Right. So, I mean, does this apply to apples and pears and oranges?
I mean, I suppose so.
All living plants that we
but they
tend
don't,
to consume?
But those ones don't grow in environments that are under stress like that. It's really these crops that grow in hot environments, and it's the heat itself that is the problem. Well, the heat causes a situation in the plants where the plants basically shut down and oxygen's allowed to build up. So it really is for rice, wheat maybe, but wheat's usually grown in a cooler environment. Rice is kind of like the prime target for this.
So there is no version of a C4 rice, is what
there
you're
is
saying.
There is no version of a C4. However, C4 photosynthesis, this particular type of concentrating, has arisen in the grasses maybe 13 times. Evolution is pretty good at making these things happen. But we're pretty bad at making these things happen.
You're sort of getting into an area which is really quite entertaining these days, and you want to genetically modify things, right?
So, well, actually, I don't. But
you don't?
Well, I'm not involved in making C4 rice, but yeah, we are involved in making...
Well, you're trying to understand some basic principles utilized. So that's
absolutely
a bit naive to say you're not trying to do it.
This whole question about what are the mechanisms by which changes to a genome can be made. What is the value? What is the downside? What are the ethics of doing so? Yeah, these are all big questions. Absolutely.
Very big questions. I mean, one of the things that I saw, I think, on your website, you're sort of interested in the shape of fruit, the architecture of things. Talk about fruit shape and how has it evolved and how has it changed over the millennia?
So fruit are really interesting. I mean, if you look at the evolution of land plants, the first things didn't have seeds and didn't have fruit. So what we're talking about, plants that, like a fern, for example, a fern has to have a sperm that swims to an egg, and from that egg, then the plant grows. But the idea of moving out into harsher environments where you have to have some method of, firstly, preserving yourself in a harsh environment until better conditions come, that's the seed innovation. The seed innovation is basically a plant stuck in suspended animation, encased with a food source and a coat. I mean, it's really an amazing concept because a seed is not, people often think a seed comes from, in the same way that a zygote comes from the fusion of a sperm and egg, and that's how another life is formed for an animal. With a plant, you have that grows for a little bit, but then the seed is really a complex structure of survival. I mean, I think of them as spaceships, basically, that are spread out on the landscape, and they are dormant until they have the right conditions. But they're basically a little plant already ready to go. Couple of leaves, a little bit of a root, is stuck in suspended animation.
That's asexual reproduction.
No, that is sexual. That's sexual. Well, so, I mean,
explain that to me because I don't know enough about this.
Well, sexual means a man and a woman, right? So a male and female coming together. Yeah. So in other words, two haploid germ cells, a male and female coming together to fuse to form the new system that will then grow. In seed plants, you just don't grow from a zygote to a plant in one go. There is this intermediary seed stage. And that intermediary seed stage is intimately tied up with the fact that you're rooted in one place. There's no point for that egg to grow into a plant on top of a plant. There has to be dispersal. And they're not going to run off there or fly off or whatever. You need some way of packaging what is essentially a very fragile thing and being able to disperse it into an environment where you don't know whether it will immediately find the right place to go. So, and a seed is a really cunning way to ensure both dispersal and survival. Well,
Well, then to clarify, because we'll I'm still a little confused by this, because I never took biology.
Excellent opportunity.
Like 10 more minutes and I'll have it all. That's great. You go back to the fern.
Yes,
you're
right.
Saying that the fern, you've got the sperm swimming around looking for an egg.
Well, all right. So you want the whole fern life cycle. This will amuse some people.
Are ferns male and female?
No.
Hermaphroditic?
You'll love this. In fact, this will make you even more confused. Take your normal fern that you're seeing, right?
Right.
Flip the leaf over. And often you'll see little brown spots on the undersurface. I don't know if you've done that and seen that, but they are what we call fertile fronds that have spores underneath them. Now, a spore is haploid, but it doesn't eat anybody else. It will go off and make a new generation, but it does not make a fern. What it makes is a tiny little heart-shaped disc of green on which the sex organs develop. And then sperm get produced, swims to the egg, needs water, okay? The whole evolution of plants on land is an evolution away from needing water. Needing water to live in, needing water for reproduction.
Right.
That's the whole thing. The seed coat, desiccation, etc. So when the sperm meets the egg in a fern, then the fern that grows up. So there's alternation of generations that animals just have no idea about. I mean, just doesn't exist for an animal. And if you think of a circle and from one type of plant, like the big fern to this tiny disc called a prothallus, these two different generations, we only have half of that. For us, a sperm comes to an egg and we get ourselves again. For a plant, sperm comes to an egg, grows up basically into another organism, which then produces sperm and eggs.
So that's
complicated.
Very inefficient.
I think the algae back in that primordial sea probably didn't care about inefficiency. But you're right. Evolution is contingent. You build on what you've got.
Let's go back to the shape of fruit, right?
Because you're right. So fruit.
This is sort of really interesting.
So fruit, the shape of fruit is an ecological consequence of their purpose. Well, let's say, what's the purpose of a flower? The purpose of a flower is to attract, get pollinated. The purpose of a fruit is to get that seed somewhere. So the shape of a fruit is the means of dispersal. So one of the groups that I study in the grasses includes the sand burrs and the feather grasses and things that have no common name. But there it's very easy to see how the same basic structure in the flowering head of the grass has in one group been modified into spines, in another group been modified into feathery plumules for wind dispersal. So one is animal dispersal, one is wind dispersal, and one is just falling on the ground. So it's very labile, very changeable through evolutionary history. Fruit shape follows function really, really clearly, just like a leaf, actually.
But most fruit just in those three methodologies falls on the ground.
Yeah, but think of an apple, right? Yeah. An apple is meant to be eaten.
Right. For us it is.
For the tree it is. It's meant to be eaten because that's how the seeds go into a bird's gut.
So you've got to get rid of the fleshy part in order for
The bird sees the fleshy part as the prize.
Right.
The tree sees the bird as the prize and loads it full of seeds. So it's a two-way game that's been played here.
What's the most odd-looking fruit? And discuss why it looks so funny. What's its evolutionary value?
That's a great question. I like Himalayan balsam as a fruit because...
we're all familiar with this.
Yeah, no, I'm going to describe it to you. I'm going to describe it to you. Because what I love about it is the way that it gets rid of its fruits. It gets rid of its fruits by a trebuchet approach. What do you call that thing? When you're at a castle in the medieval times and you want to break the wall down, you put a big boulder into this lever thing.
The Monty Python.
Exactly.
Catapult.
You're throwing the cow.
Yeah, right. Absolutely. I now understand. Go on.
So these fruits are adapted to be thrown out like slingshots. So the fruit... It builds up tension by putting water into the cells, builds up so much tension that with the slightest touch, the angles of the fruit reveal themselves, and the inside has basically a throwing cup that catapults the seed out and 2, 3, 4, 5 meters. I mean, a long distance.
And what is this fruit called? What's the plant?
Himalayan balsam.
Balsam. B-O-L-S-O-M-R-A-N.
Yeah.
And you call it fruit. Is it fruit that people who live in the Himalaya eat?
I think
not all fruit is edible for us.
I think they just avoid it as it hits them. I don't know. I mean, I think the coconut is an amazing fruit and such the most useful thing to have around, really. You can use the husk, you can the meat, you can drink it. It's just an incredible, I mean, one of the main plant hormones was first synthesized from that cytokinin from the embryo of the coconut. There are lots of cool things out there.
Well, one of the fruits that I never had as a kid, but now you get it almost all the year round, is a kiwi fruit.
Oh, yeah. Now, the Chinese gooseberry. Exactly.
Right. Yeah. Now, why is it called kiwi? Is it anything to do with New Zealand?
No, not at all.
Not at all.
Just marketing. Yeah, brilliant marketing. This is the Chinese gooseberry that was brought to, grows well in New Zealand. I'm sure it's away from its natural pests. And they market it as the kiwi, which of course is...
Oh, so they are actually grown in New Zealand.
Grown in New Zealand. Yeah, they're grown everywhere, right?
Right. Yeah. But,
and that fruit looks so good on a pavlova. Yeah.
But it's also, you know, everyone's got a very soft spot for New Zealand. You know,
yeah,
it's
why is that?
Oh, because it's so close to Australia.
No, you know, Australians don't have a soft spot.
No. Okay. Hey, Andrew, we've come to the end of our allotted 28 minutes or so. Your own particular research goal, if you could just summarize in a minute or two here, what is it that in the very near future you think you will have discovered that will really make a major difference in our understanding of these architectural features and the like you've been talking about?
I think we have a pretty poor idea of how plants integrate, what their genes are telling them and what the environment's telling them. I think we're grappling at how a plant really, when you see a plant, you're not seeing this sort of very predetermined structure like an animal. You're really seeing something that is in this free communication with the environment. I think that is the area that can tell us most about how plants can be, how they work by themselves, but also how they can be modified for things that we might use for.
In your area, I mean, there is a climate change going on. Do you think that this is an important and growing area for our own survival?
Oh, yeah. Absolutely. And anyone who sees The Martian would know that, you know, if we go to other planets as well, I mean, plants are the one thing that can take the energy of the universe and give it to us. And there's nothing else like that, really. So I think the more we understand about this, really, I would say, an area of biology that has been given less importance because they're not animals, I really think they're really important and really alien and really beautiful.
One quick final question. I remember reading somewhere that trees somehow communicate.
Right, volatiles. Yeah, absolutely.
Right. I mean, you do damage to one tree, there's volatiles that...
That tell the next tree to produce the chemicals to stop the invasion.
Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, plants can do amazing things. So they're very, very sensitive. That's their real nature, is they're much more sensitive. And this is why over half of our pharmaceuticals are plant-based, because plants have to protect themselves standing in the one place. Therefore, they have all of these wonderful antimicrobial compounds, etc.
Wonderful. So Andrew Doust from the department that calls itself Plant Biology, etc., Oklahoma State University in Stillwater, Oklahoma. Thank you so much for being here.
Thank you.
And again, I'd like to thank Kelly Burley, who is just helping us put this program together in the studio of KOSU in Stillwater, Oklahoma. Lauren Terrasas, who's going to make it all sound much better than it is in real life. And you for listening. And we'll be back next week with our third and final program from Oklahoma State University in Stillwater, Oklahoma. Adios.